Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands is going full throttle. Today, we'll play some of your best songs in the contest for one of our judges, party rocker Andrew W.K.
You've been accompanying Wachovia Bank Robbers on the air drums.
Air drums, it's my go-to air instrument, more than guitar and more than vocals.
And I'll talk to the filmmaking descendant of Errol Morris and Werner Herzog, the young director of an incredible, mind-boggling documentary where Death Squad members gleefully reenact their torture and killing for the camera.
And they were all boastful. They were all eager to tell me what they've done. And not just that, they would take me to the places where they killed, launch into these spontaneous demonstrations.
Joshua Oppenheimer, the filmmaker behind The Act of Killing. I'm Kurt Anderson. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Oh, Mr. Neely, where did you come from?
From your blood. Just one drop of your blood contains billions of strands of DNA, the building blocks of life.
Resurrecting the woolly mammoth sounds far-fetched, but the latest advances in biotechnology have some scientists thinking that the revival of extinct species may be a question of when rather than if.
We can get DNA out of these extinct species. There's tons of extinct species to study. And I felt that the future of conservation was in, you know, trying to restore these gaps in nature.
Welcome to Jurassic Park. That's later this hour. But first, Studio 360 wants to hear you rock. We want to hear you rap. We want to hear any of the music you made while you were in high school, so long as it wasn't in a marching band or a school choir. It's for our latest listener challenge, Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands. The deadline for entering is Sunday, July 21st, but in the meantime, we're going to listen to some of the 200-plus entries we've gotten so far. I am joined now by one of our distinguished judges to do so, the rocker Andrew W.K. Andrew, welcome back.
Oh, thank you very much.
So, you are known as the pioneer of a high-energy genre known as party rock, but back in high school, what kind of music did you play in Ann Arbor?
Well, Ann Arbor, of course, Ann Arbor, Michigan, is famous for its radical, far-out, almost psychedelic history.
Before you were born.
Yes, absolutely. But there was still that thread and that spirit, that current, continued and continues to this day. So I was into a lot of weird music, and my friends and I were in bands that people could call experimental or avant-garde. To us, it was just freak-out music.
Well, we have a clip
from
one of your bands. This band is called AAB.
Mm. Jeez.
What do you remember about that band?
Well, first of all, it stands for Ancient Art of Boar. And my
B-O-A-R, like
yes,
a pig.
Yes, like a beautiful young pig. And my friend Jaime Morales named the band that, and he was in an early version of it, although I'm not sure which song this is. There was times when it was just me by myself.
Well, this is, I think, just you by yourself. It's a song called Bright Dole.
Oh, yes. This is by myself.
That is Andrew W.K. playing Bright Dole as AAB years ago.
I just remembered, though, on this one song, this is the only song on this release, this cassette album, that also featured my friend Fred Thomas, who you may be familiar with from his band Saturday Looks Good to Me, among many other great groups. So he was playing guitar on that. I wasn't entirely alone.
So your high school band life was this crucible of real music. It wasn't just you that broke out.
Right? I guess you're right. There was a lot going on, and I'm very thankful to have been a part of it.
Let's listen to a few of the entries in our Battle of the Bands contest. The first one is a band called Wachovia Bank Robbers.
And that name came from the fact that they actually witnessed the robbery of a Wachovia bank in their hometown, Lynchburg, Virginia. And then they had to change their name to WBR because Wachovia Bank objected.
They actually were heard of the band enough to tell them to stop.
That's pretty cool, right?
That's a great honor.
Exactly. So this is WBR, formerly known as Wachovia Bank Robbers. And now that Wachovia is out of business,
yeah.
I guess it doesn't matter anymore.
Yeah, they can take the name back.
Exactly.
They outlasted.
This song is called Lucky Cloud, and they recorded it in 2002.
Girl, you know I love you. We'll be together.
So, Andrew W.K., you've been accompanying Wachovia Bank Robbers on the air drums.
Air drums, it's my go-to air instrument, more than guitar and more than vocals. And I like the drum sound. That actually sounded a bit like the drum sound on my recording. It's that nice room drum sound. What a great title, too. Lucky Cloud.
So that you think they're a contender?
Oh, absolutely.
How hard is it to name a band? When you're in high school, is that a big deal?
Yes. And I struggled with it every time I ever was in a position to name a band. I still have pages and pages of band names that I didn't use. Sometimes I ended up using them for album titles or song titles or lyrics, but it was actually a painful process. I would go so far to say it's painful. I remember even driving around looking at people on the sidewalk and thinking how lucky they were that they didn't have to try to come up with a band name right at that moment.
Talk about first world problems. Well, a lot of our entries have great names. The great names don't necessarily correspond to the great bands.
Well.
And I won't make any judgments, but one of my favorite band names that have entered themselves are Johnny Puke and the Regurgitators.
Holy smokes, I almost puked right then.
That's a very high school band name.
That's fantastic.
And yeah. Their song is H.D. Thoreau. So they're going both ways.
Like high definition?
No, like Henry David.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The next one that we're going to listen to, this is by a group of then girls, still girls because it was only recorded in 2011, named B, Rita, and Maeve. And this song is called The River. They recorded it while they were at Hume Fog High School and Christ Presbyterian Academy in Nashville, Tennessee.
Nice.
That is The River by B, Rita, and Maeve in Nashville from just 2 years ago, actually.
Wow. Advanced vocal harmonies.
I mean, and it doesn't sound like kids.
No.
I mean, in every sense, it sounds older.
It sounds like old, old women.
Yeah.
In a good way.
In a great way.
Yeah. They could be, you know, from 1,000 years ago.
Or hundreds, anyway.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe you're right.
The next entry in Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands is by a band called The Orphans. And they're not sure if it's 1980 or 81, but roughly then. And
all right.
The song recorded while they were at Westfield High School in Westfield, New Jersey. It's called Fourth Dimension, but I have to give a caveat. They didn't record – this was written in 1980, 81. They recorded it when they had a 25th reunion. So you as the judges are going to have to decide if that's kosher, but let's listen.
Okay.
In the fourth dimension, don't want no dissension from the one.
Wow. I was thinking, I admire the idea that you would ever get back together with a childhood band like that. So even the fact that they re-recorded this, I still appreciate the spirit of it.
Maybe some special award will be created for them or something.
Yeah,
or
the Fourth
Seniors
Dimension
Division.
Award.
Yeah. did you ever get back together with the high school kids you played with?
No, but I've continued to be friends and make music occasionally over the years. But I never really thought about it. I would love to. What a great idea. It takes some real effort, but it would be worth while.
Andrew W.K., it is great to see you again, and
I'll see
you again in a few weeks.
Okay, thank you, Kurt.
There is still time to share your high school band's best song with America as part of Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands. You might make it onto the playlist of our favorites, and one band will have its song covered by Andrew W.K. and Tao Nguyen. All the details are at studio360.org/myhighschoolband.
Rock band back in high school.
Excellent.
That's cool.
Coming up, I'll talk with the filmmaker behind The Act of Killing, which is a powerful and singular new documentary about a whole country's surreal state of denial.
We need a film that exposes for Indonesians themselves the nature of this regime, the kind of normality built atop a mass grave, so that Indonesians themselves can stop denying what they already know to be the case.
Filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Documentaries about mass political killings almost always follow the same basic formula. Archival footage, some talking heads, harrowing testimony from victims, the perpetrators either denying or apologizing for the evil they've done. But the new documentary, The Act of Killing, does without all of those conventions. It's about Indonesia's anti-communist purge in the 1960s, which probably killed hundreds of thousands of people. And it's told entirely from the perspective of its unpunished, unrepentant perpetrators. It's American filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer asked Death Squad leaders to recreate their tortures and murders for the camera. The result is a surreal and disturbing film within a film. Errol Morris and Werner Herzog are executive producers of the movie, and Herzog calls The Act of Killing, quote, unprecedented in the history of cinema, which I think is absolutely right. It is astonishing and brilliant, and I am very pleased to have Joshua Oppenheimer with me today. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much.
You began intending to make a more conventional film, right? And talking to the survivors and the children of the people who were killed and
well,
so on.
I'm not sure I know how to make a more conventional film, but the film would have had a more conventional point of view in the sense that it would have we would have seen the killings, heard about the killings through the eyes of the survivors. But every time I would film with the survivors, we would be stopped. The military would come and stop us. They would take our equipment. They would arrest us. They would detain us. And it was very difficult to get anything done. And so we went back to the Indonesian human rights community with the survivors with whom I was working and said, is it a good idea to make this film? Can we make this film? Is it too soon? Is it too sensitive? Is it too dangerous? Everybody said, no, you're on to something extremely important. We need a film that exposes for Indonesians themselves the nature of this regime, the kind of normality built atop a mass grave, so that Indonesians themselves can stop denying what they already know to be the case, essentially creating the space for Indonesians themselves to start talking about what really happened and the consequences of that for the present.
Because there have been no reconciliation commissions as in, for instance, South Africa.
Oh, exactly, because the men who've done it are still in power.
Well, and so once you decided talking to the survivors is proving impossible, had you already talked to these now elderly perpetrators and already won their confidence?
When I was working with the survivors, they would occasionally send me on these sort of missions to film, meet perpetrators who they thought would talk to me, who they suspected had killed their relatives. So I was sent on these quite painful missions. And when I would meet these perpetrators, they would boast, invariably.
Really?
Yeah, they would. I would walk.
So that wasn't just the few you put in the film. This was their standard MO.
Exactly. And then I was, and then once it was impossible to continue with the survivors, too difficult, too dangerous, then one of the main survivors with whom I was working said, Josh, continue to film the perpetrators. They will boast, like the ones you've already met. They will appear to be proud, as though intuiting that they may not really be proud. And in their boasting, the audience will see exactly why we're so afraid and the nature of this regime. So from that point on, I filmed every perpetrator I could find across the region. And they were all boastful. They were all eager to tell me what they've done. And not just that, they would say, "Let me. I guess you want to see where I did it." And they would take me to the places where they killed, show me how they'd gone about it, launch into these spontaneous demonstrations.
Which must have been amazing when it first happened. Like, I can't believe I'm getting this.
Yeah, at first it was totally shocking, and I felt as though I'd been entrusted by the survivors to gather information of world historical importance. We're talking about the deaths of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people in one province, and no one had ever documented it before.
And at what point did you come up with this idea of them reenacting in this Hollywood-y way the various scenes of their brutality and killings?
Well, before I met the main character, Anwar, when I was still working in my way across the countryside, I was already saying to people very openly, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. Your whole society's based on it. Your lives are shaped by it. You want to show me what you've done in these simple demonstrations. Show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. I will film the process, film the demonstrations to try and understand what this means to you and your society. So I was quite open. The method was very much we would shoot a scene, screen it for Anwar and his friends, and they would think about what to shoot next. So you can liken the method to a man painting his own portrait, and he paints a little, steps back from the canvas, looks, paints a little more. And I think maybe the core drama of the film comes when he realizes that he can't make a portrait of himself which is at once beautiful and true.
Well, and it makes for this one of the many jaw-dropping moments in this film of – because it's harrowing to think this is a man who killed people in just this way. Now we're reenacting it in this kind of over-the-top Hollywood-looking way. It's goofy as well as chilling.
I think humor plays a really important role in the film. It's not a – I mean, for some people it's utterly painful, and I think in the end it's painful, but it is a funny film.
And the audience, after a while – frees itself to laugh, sort of.
And I think there's two kinds of humor in the film. Of course, there's these moments of surreal absurdity where you just see a whole regime being unmasked in the most shameless way, and it is absurd and funny, like a scene where Anwar envisions his redemption in heaven, and there waiting for him are his victims with a medal who thank him for killing them and sending them to heaven.
Atas eksekusi yang saudara lakukan terhadap diri saya.
Which is amazing. Now, was that his idea?
That was his idea, and it was a direct response to him having played a victim in a previous scene and felt a kind of trauma.
Well, and this regular screening of essentially not the dailies, but of finished scenes to this guy, this former killer, is extraordinary to watch him and his little grandchildren watching it. But it also, in a journalistic way, as an audience member, I'm thinking the filmmakers didn't lie or trick anybody. He's fully aware of what this film is.
Yeah, that's right. You know, every reenactment, every dramatization implied a denial of the moral meaning of what he had done. I mean, you can't make a cowboy scene about hundreds of people being killed and not be in denial of the true meaning of that action. And so to make the scene was a kind of insistence on that denial. And then I would screen the material back wondering if Anwar might recognize some of the things of which he was in denial in the kind of mirror of the movie. And each time, I think he would, but he wouldn't have yet the courage to know to express that, and he would displace it into the next scene. And so it wasn't a surprise, ultimately, in hindsight, it's not surprising, that the fiction scenes themselves, which I saw as these kind of allegories for impunity, ultimately became this kind of prism through which he would somehow confront his broken self.
And he seems finally, in one particular scene, to do that in a very, he gets emotional way. Having spent so much time with him going through this process, did you feel this is real? He's not playing me in some way?
Yeah, I knew at the very end it's real, but there's a moment just before it becomes real where he is really playing, where he says, I think in desperation, when he's finally forced to confront what he's done, he offers this kind of generic confession where he says, now I feel what my victims feel, don't I? And of course, if I said yes, then it would reassure him that what his victims went through was no worse than being in a movie. And I am very grateful that at that moment there was nothing technical like lighting or sound to distract me, and I could just be in my heart and listen to him and be present and say, no, of course you're not feeling what your victims felt, because what they went through was so much, much, much worse.
Which is about the only time you speak in the film at length, and has all the more power for it.
And I think in that moment, somehow the bottom drops out for him, and he's forced to gaze into the abyss, the unbridgeable abyss between all the unimaginable horror that he's put people through and all the stories he's told himself, all the lies that he and the whole regime has told itself to run away from what they've done. It's interesting, you asked this question, or you mentioned about Anwar seeing the film, knowing about the film. His reaction to the finished film was very interesting. Of course, he knew what was in it, so he knew it would be a painful experience to watch. For quite a while, he would say, I would say it's nearly finished, I want to show it to you because it's going to come out soon. He would say, I'm not ready to see it because maybe later, maybe later. Finally, I said to him, look, it's out. I have to tell you what's in it. You haven't wanted to see it. Then he found himself at the center of a very big news story in Indonesia. The film has made an enormous impact there. And he said, I need to see the film. So by then it was unsafe. I could no longer go to Indonesia safely. I could probably get in but would never get out again. I arranged for him to go to a place where there'd be good internet connection. I didn't know if I could bring him out of the country because he was now in the news as a mass killer. So we brought him to a place where I could be with him through the screening by Skype, and we sat together. He could talk to me throughout the screening, and at the end of the screening, he sat in this kind of stunned silence for a long time, tearful. Then he said, this film shows what it's like to be me, and it's an honest film, and I'm glad I was able to be so honest, and I will stand by the film. And it was a strange thing to say, except if you remember that he may come under real pressure to denounce the film.
Has it been seen widely in Indonesia, been released?
On the 10th of December, International Human Rights Day last year, they held 50 screenings in 30 cities, and that's grown exponentially since then. So the screenings range in size from 30 to 600 people. By the 1st of April, there had been 500 screenings in 95 cities, and every week there's more than the previous week. But perhaps most gratifying has been the Indonesian news media. So, for example, Indonesia's leading news magazine, Tempo, published a special double edition about the film in which they gathered 75 pages of boastful testimony from killers all around the country, showing that basically the act of killing is a repeatable experiment, that there's tens of thousands of Anwars around the country.
Really? So this that's a happy ending, because it seems as though this film has sort of unlocked the silence.
Yeah, I think the film, it's not the only thing to be sure, but it has helped catalyze a sea change in how Indonesians talk about their past. It's like the child from the emperor's new clothes, pointing at the king and saying, look, the king is naked. And everybody knew it, but was too afraid to say it. And now that it's been said so emotionally by the perpetrators themselves, there's no going back. And Indonesians, therefore, are talking for the first time openly and without fear to a degree, because the film has opened the way. And it's certainly the best part of completing the film.
And yet, as I've said from the beginning, it is this bizarre work of art. It is not at all the medicinal, earnest kind of documentary that listeners may think, yeah, I don't want to see that. It's in its powerful, strange, disturbing way, it's incredibly entertaining.
I think, in fact, that's why it's having the effect that it's having. You know, I talked about humor earlier. There's I think when Indonesians see these moments which we find absurd, crazy. For them, it's the unmasking of the whole regime. So it's both terribly moving, but also cathartic and joyful, because finally the regime is showing its true rotten logic.
Well, I encourage everyone to go see it. Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much.
It was a great conversation. Thank you.
The Act of Killing is playing in theaters across the country. You can find out exactly where at studio360.org.
What species is this?
It's a velociraptor.
You bred raptors.
Bringing animals back from extinction has been the stuff of science fiction for a while, Jurassic Park being the best-known example.
Don't you see the danger inherent in what you're doing here? Genetic power is the most awesome force the planet's ever seen, but you wield it like a kid that's found his dad's gun.
But now, a biotech movement called de-extinction is trying to do it for real. Reporter Britt Ray talks to an artist and a scientist who are bound by a passion to resurrect lost species.
Isabella Kirkland paints animals, but animals that have been dead for a long time.
As I've been doing research for individual species that have gone extinct, it's been really tricky to work from specimens because sometimes they're old and discolored and moth-eaten. I have to be able to sort of turn it in my mind's eye and view it as an entire animal.
She should know. She's held the bones of the laughing owl and horns of the blue buck and even the eggs of the Syrian ostrich.
Every extinct thing I've held in my hands, I'll never forget the first time I opened a cabinet, someone opened a cabinet for me and I was able to hold them and I kept saying, you know, shouldn't I have a mask on and gloves and can I move it?
In a way, Kirkland's paintings serve as a visual time capsule for an apocalyptic future. Her painting Gone has 63 animals in it. Every one of them has disappeared since the colonization of the New World.
I begin each of the paintings that I do with a database, really. So I have a rubric like extinction or invasiveness or new discovery.
Gone looks like a Dutch master painting with a menagerie of animals on a table. There's the bright yellow and green Carolina parakeet perched on a twig. It died out in 1918. Below it sits the tiny golden toad. The last one was seen in the Costa Rican forests in 1989. Front and center is the most striking. Martha, the last passenger pigeon. She died in 1914 in the Cincinnati Zoo. Kirkland painted Gone so that we remember what has been lost, but now it's become the poster for a new scientific discovery that asks the question, what if we could bring the animals back? De-extinction.
It's my job to bring the bird back to life.
That's Ben Novak, a genetic biologist who's working to bring the passenger pigeon out of artistic imagination and back into the wild. Both Novak and Isabella Kirkland are working with the Long Now Foundation on a project called Revive and Restore. Bringing extinct species back to life is something out of a sci-fi movie, but this is reputable work. It's funded by universities like Harvard and UC Santa Cruz. This past spring, Revive and Restore held its first conference at National Geographic's headquarters.
Hello.
Novak presented on his leading effort at Revive and Restore, bringing back the passenger pigeon.
I want to bring them out of our imagination and get them back into the wild.
Or at least, a passenger pigeon.
The Great Comeback, as it is now officially titled.
At the turn of the 20th century, the birds flew in flocks of a mile wide. One flock was reported to be 300 miles long and took 14 hours to pass a single point. By 1914, we had hunted them out of the skies. And now their stuffed carcasses sit in natural history museums all over North America. You could say Ben has been planning this comeback since he was in junior high.
That's me when I was 13, doing science fair. Actually, I still have those pants. I wear those.
Back then, he created a science fair project about the dodo.
I was kind of in love with it at the time. I loved birds. I loved birds a lot. And the dodo bird, it was, you know, it's the icon of extinction, dead as a dodo, as they say.
And what I learned was the dodo bird happens to be a giant extinct pigeon.
And learning that about the dodo bird gave me the pigeon bug.
The idea behind it is simple, although the method is complicated, and Ben has teams of scientists working with him. They start by pinching the toe of a dusty passenger pigeon carcass to get its DNA. Next, they unravel it to read the code inside. Once Novak can read the DNA, he tries to find a closely related living match. Kind of like trying to find an organ donor. In this case, it's the band-tailed pigeon. And if it works, the band-tailed pigeon will give birth to a clone of a dead passenger pigeon.
I'm a little concerned about the passenger pigeon.
David Ehrenfeld teaches conservation biology at Rutgers University.
Let's say it works. There's no guarantee that it will, but let's say it works, and out of this egg laid by a band-tailed pigeon comes something with passenger pigeon DNA. The mother? The mother's not a passenger pigeon. Passenger pigeons and band-tailed pigeons eat different things. They have different calls. They fly differently. Is that band-tailed pigeon going to be able to raise a passenger pigeon?
Many scientists are skeptical about de-extinction. Not that it can't be done, but that it's pointless. Ehrenfeld thinks the passenger pigeon is a particularly bad candidate, since it lived in flocks of millions.
Let's say we bring back a heroic effort and bring back 20 passenger pigeons. What is going to happen? I'm not very optimistic about that.
But Novak says that if he can't bring the whole species back, even one bird is a major step towards understanding how to support the natural world that we love.
And I don't think anyone gets into these projects or even science, looking at graphs and looking at data, and that's all you see. When I look at DNA sequences, I see living animals. I see animals, a pair of birds coming together and breeding to make some new offspring. I see these events in history that shape what this data actually looks like.
But if Novak succeeds, Isabella Kirkland might have to go back to her big painting, Gone, with all the extinct species on it, and update it, taking out the passenger pigeon. She'll have to find some new extinct animal to put in the center. Maybe the Sumatran rhino will show its head. Or maybe something else. There are, after all, and will continue to be, lots of candidates.
All I really want with the work is two things: to get people to slow down and think more. I just would like people to ask themselves the kinds of questions that the work asks itself. So, what does matter? We are animals that rely on a certain amount of hope, and I find this whole idea of de-extinction very, very hopeful.
For Studio 360, I'm Britt Ray.
You can see Isabella Kirkland's painting Gone at studio360.org. Still ahead this hour of Studio 360, a band that's got as many intramural romantic entanglements as Fleetwood Mac, and one odd man out. Right, it's the bassist who is the fifth wheel. Of course.
Of course.
Right? But you can play the rock star, right?
Well, there's nothing playing about it, Kurt.
Yeah. A live performance from Radiation City, plus a new episode from Jack Handy's epic travel adventure, The Stench of Honolulu. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com.
This is Studio 360, and I am Kurt Anderson. When I stumbled across Radiation City's music last year, I knew nothing about them. Not that they'd only been together for 3 years, not that they're the hot band in Portland, not their complicated interpersonal dynamic, just that their songs were lovely, uncannily perfect pop like nothing I'd heard, not for decades anyhow. Radiation City has just released its second album, Animals in the Median, and they join me now. Cameron Spees, Elizabeth Ellison, Randy Bemrose, Matt Rafferty, Patty King. Welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
So I've heard two different stories about the origins of the band's name, and I sort of like both. One is that you imagine your music as what would be found in a time capsule after a nuclear apocalypse, thus Radiation City. The other is that it derived from you guys touring through lots of rad cities. So which is truer?
We've actually never thought about that second one, but
really?
But I like it.
So there's urban myths already about you. That's
yeah,
great.
Let's just keep that going. Let's see what else people come up with.
Before we talk some more, would you play one of your songs from the new album?
Sure. Sure.
Which one will this be?
Foreign Bodies.
And that was Radiation City performing Foreign Bodies. Cameron, you sing on some songs, but Lizzie, you and Patty certainly dominate the musical tapestry of this band. Was that an idea of this, how this band should sound from the beginning, is this girl sound?
Yeah, I definitely, when I record the vocals, it's usually layers and layers of, you know, Ronette-type harmonies and girl group background vocals, but it's really hard before she joined the band, it was really hard to capture that type of sound. And although we don't have a backing choir or anything, at least she can molt the vocals and really thicken it and make it.
And you've got your Phil Spector here in Cameron, I guess, right? Good. Okay. That'll work out well.
I'm just as crazy.
Your origin story sounds sort of like a super meet cute premise of some movie or novel set in the 60s or 70s. Lizzie and Cameron, you met and got together and then decided, let's start a band?
She was my main squeeze, yeah.
I was.
And there are now, to again, in the implausible, fictional nature of this band, there are now two couples. Now, you guys are a couple as well, right?
That one over there, the drummer, and me.
Oh, he and you. Oh, okay, sorry. Oh, right, it's the bassist who is the fifth wheel. Of course. Right?
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Does it ever feel like a fifth wheel thing?
Sometimes, when I'm hanging on the side of the van, dragging along the freeway.
But you can play the rock star, right?
And exactly.
Like have girls and have fun.
Well, there's nothing playing about it, Kurt.
Yeah. Really?
No, I'm
You can
kidding.
Live. I meant live the rock star life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you guys worry, given this complexity, do you ever worry like, oh, what if one of these relationships ends?
We like danger.
But seriously, you know, Fleetwood Mac, you know, the precedents are not, I mean, I guess they go on.
Yeah, they go, you know, we like to think that if something catastrophic happens, which, you know, we hope doesn't, that we'll be able to carry on and we'll, you know, put the band first.
Mamas and the Papas?
Yeah, we've had both those references this tour.
So you're from Portland. A few years ago, I was doing a thing in Portland, and I said to an audience, I described Portland as, it reminds me of where I live in Brooklyn, if Brooklyn didn't have black people.
Exactly!
And I'm glad to hear you.
No, it's frustrating.
They were momentary. They didn't laugh for like a full second as they looked around and were worried about whether they should laugh, and then they did. Cameron, you have said that there's one song on this new album called So Long that is about people in Portland being just too nice and never saying what's what and cutting to the chase. Is that
Yeah,
fair?
That's a part of it. Yeah, it was an expression of frustration for certain things that go unsaid or things that go
passive-aggressively
Yeah,
untold.
Passive-aggressive behavior. And even we exhibit that sometimes as individuals. And, you know, that's part of the frustration is self-reflection, I think, maybe.
So you never work with outside producers at all? You self-produce?
Correct.
Well, and is that because you're perfectionists and therefore you can self-produce?
Yes.
Or, yes?
Well, there's that element, but there's also, it's kind of out of necessity. We don't have really any budget for recording at this point, and so we began that way.
You're rock stars. You must have huge
I mean, budget. We have tons of money, but we like spending it on there drugs you. And girls.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Now I hear you.
Yeah.
But doing that, really being your own masters in that way, does it force you as a quintet to be more critical of each other as you're doing it because you don't have this other person to be the parent?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I would think. Could you guys play one more song?
Yes.
Sure.
And what is this?
L.A. Beach.
Water, salt to sandy road, blistered feet, holy holler, what a daughter, we were breathing underneath the shallow sea, oxygen is running thin, the sure.
That was Radiation City playing L.A. Beach from their new album, Animals in the Median. They'll be touring America all summer, and you can go to studio360.org to find out where. And while you're at the website, you could also see a video of Radiation City performing for us and hear a bonus song recorded right here. That's studio360.org. Thank you all once again for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Jack Handy, the creator of Saturday Night Live's Deep Thoughts, is a master of absurdist humor kept short and bittersweet. But now he's letting his deadpan comedy stretch out a little bit with his first novel, The Stench of Honolulu. We've been featuring excerpts from it throughout the summer. Previously on The Stench of Honolulu.
We headed upriver into the vast, untamed vastness of Hawaii. We were attacked by a huge swarm of bats. That's when I noticed the solar eclipse, which didn't seem like a good sign either.
And now, the third installment.
We sailed on, into the unknown. How strange that we have explored the moon and the other planets, and yet we know so little about Hawaii. Have you noticed someone is following us? Don said. I started to say, have you noticed your brain is following us? But I realized he was serious. I tried to take a look through the binoculars, but Don told me to wait until we got the strap off from around his neck, which took us a few minutes. By then, the boat had dropped below the bend. I had a bad feeling about this. Following does not usually end well. One time I started following this actress. It's not like I'm crazy. I was just obsessed with her. I asked Don the same question I asked the judge. Just because something is behind something, is it actually following? Don had the same answer as the judge. Yes, it's following. We came to a sign floating on a buoy. The words on the sign would give a chill to any sane man. Entering National Park. Dark clouds gathered overhead. Then, without warning, it began to rain. And it kept raining, on. Who would have thought it would rain so much in the jungle? It must have rained for nearly 20 minutes. Not hard the whole time, but still raining. Don said to get used to it, because it was going to rain a lot more than that. Oh great, now Don's a weatherman. When the mist cleared, something amazing began rising up from the jungle. Then I realized it wasn't rising up, we were getting closer. It was the fabulous ruins of an ancient civilization. As a joke, I pretended to be asleep. Don kept trying to wake me up, but I would not wake up. Good joke, huh? Then I pretended to wake up, see the ruins, and go right back to sleep. I have to admit the ruins were impressive, but like so many civilizations, they forgot the one rule that might have saved them. Don't let vines grow all over you.
That's Jack Handy reading from his new novel. You can catch up on parts 1 and 2 at studio360.org, and be sure to tune in next week to hear the conclusion. That is, the dramatic conclusion of The Stench of Honolulu. And that is it for this hour of Studio 360. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget that there are just days left to send us the best music you made in high school.
All the details for Studio 360's Battle of the High School Bands are at studio360.org. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferam,
Alana Harper,
Anne Hepperman,
Eric Malinsky,
Chloe Plant,
Rachel Lewis Krisky,
Ellen Mayer,
Mark Sheely.
And thanks to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegen. You can find out what's going on behind the scenes by following us on Twitter. That's at Studio360Show and at KB Anderson. That's Anderson, S-E-N.
Studio 360 is supported by Scion, presenting the new 2014 Scion TC. With modified steering and suspension to improve driving precision and a new look, the Scion TC is designed to go the distance. Learn more at scion.com. And by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts. Art works.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time, the youngest guests we've ever had on this show.
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
Yeah? We made a lot of money?
Yeah, we made a lot of money.
Like, how much would you make in a day?
About $1,600.
No, really? The Middle School Medal of Unlocking the Truth. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.